Well, if you have your Bibles, I invite you to grab those this morning and turn to Matthew chapter 5. I'm glad that you're here this morning. We're going to talk about one of the most practical and perplexing verses in all of the Bible. Here's the practical part. Jesus is going to tell us, his disciples, he's going to tell us how to respond when we've been wronged. Anybody here ever been wronged? Go ahead and lift your hand if you've ever been wronged. Okay, it seems unanimous. Sometime along the way, along the path, somebody did something to you that wasn't fair. You didn't deserve it. It just wasn't right. Here's the perplexing part. In our passage, Jesus says this, and don't look yet. We're going to get to it in just a minute. But he says, whoever smites you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. In fact, I'm going to tell you that as perplexing as that statement is, I mean, how does a person get hit in the face and not do anything about it? And in fact, turn the other cheek. I mean, as perplexing as that is, what Jesus means actually goes much further than that. In fact, that might be the easiest part of the section. All right, let's go ahead and look at it together. Matthew chapter 5, we're going to begin in verse 38. We're going to go through verse 42. It's kind of a two-part message. We're going to begin it this week. We're going to continue it next week, and then we're going to attach the last verses of the chapter together. They all sort of flow along with the same theme. All right, Matthew 5, verse 38. You've heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. And it's a pretty shocking statement. Don't resist evil. We're going to have to figure out what that says, right? What that means. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue you at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him too. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. And the problem is, most of us are not wired this way. In fact, maybe none of us. Right? Most of us are wired more like one of my favorite childhood book series about Alexander. You know that song, that book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day? All right, there's a co-book to that, and it's called I'll Fix Anthony. Most of us are more wired like this. Judith Vorst book for children. The little brother, Alexander, says, my brother Anthony can read books now, but he won't read any books to me. He plays checkers with Bruce from his school, but when I want to play, he says, go away or I'll clobber you. I let him wear my Snoopy sweatshirt, but he never lets me borrow his sword. Mother says, deep down in his heart, Anthony loves me. Anthony says, deep down in his heart, he thinks I stink. Mother says, deep, deep down in his heart, where he doesn't even know it, Anthony loves me. Anthony says, deep, deep down in his heart, he still thinks I stink. But when I'm six, I'll fix Anthony. When I'm six, I'll float, but Anthony will sink to the bottom. I'll dive off the board, but Anthony will change his mind. I'll breathe in out when I should, but Anthony will only go glug, glug, glug. Anthony is chasing me out of the playroom. He says I stink. He says he's going to clobber me. I have to run now, but I won't have to run when I'm six. When I'm six, I'll fix Anthony. I mean, that's sort of how we feel, right? We probably feel more like Alexander does. When somebody has done something wrong to us, when we've been wronged, when life isn't fair, it's very natural for us to want to figure out, how am I going to get revenge later on? How am I going to figure out, you know, how to get payback? We're just sort of wired for revenge and for justice. Whether we want to fix a family member, or whether it's a person at work, or maybe it's a one-time friend who has done us wrong, we just normally, naturally want to seek justice and really want to seek revenge. And so when we read Jesus' words, I mean, they're tough. We don't like them very much. In fact, I guarantee that some of you are going to really struggle with what I'm going to say this morning. And not because I'm saying it, I hope that you're going to see that we're just going to walk down carefully through what this text says, exactly what Jesus says, try to explain some of the things that are a little more confusing. As we talk about some things that I think will challenge you, and some of you might really feel burdened about it, I just want to ask you to ask this question. Is this what the Bible says? What does the Bible say? What does Jesus want for me? And we'll try to determine why this is so important that Jesus would include this section again in the greatest sermon of all time here on the Sermon on the Mount. So what I want to ask this morning is this question. What is a Christian supposed to do? I mean, how are we supposed to respond when we are wronged, when we're treated unfairly? And I think Jesus gives a couple of answers. I'm going to kind of outline it this way. We're going to give two sort of overview answers, and then we're going to talk about four things under the second answer that we'll describe. And we'll just see how far we get this morning. We're going to pick up some of it next Sunday morning. Here's the first thing that Jesus says about this question. What is a Christian supposed to do when they're wronged? Number one is this. We're going to have to do battle with the tendencies of our dog-eat-dog mentality. All right, first of all, I know that, especially for some of you, that English is more of a second language. Bringing up an idiom like dog-eat-dog doesn't mean anything to you. And I really struggled to find another way to explain this and just decided that I couldn't come up with anything that explained what I was trying to say here, what I think Jesus was trying to say better. You can help me out later on. So now I'm going to have to explain what dog-eat-dog means. All right, but we're going to have to do battle with the tendencies of our dog-eat-dog mentality. And dog-eat-dog means this. It's used to describe a situation in which people will do anything to be successful, even if what they do harms other people. And boy, we're wired this way, and our culture is wired this way. Hey, listen, you got to do whatever you got to do to be successful, and if you got to hurt a few people in the process, that's just the way that it goes. It's sort of a ruthless self-interest is maybe the way that we could explain it, but I didn't want to say that in my main point, so I said dog eat dog, but it's really, we're going to have to do battle with this tendency of this ruthless self-interest. We do what we need to do in order for us to get ahead, no matter who it hurts or how much it hurts them. We're going to struggle with this naturally. In fact, probably our society, particularly our American society, pushes us this way. Americans live by some of these creeds. See if some of these sound familiar. I've got my rights. Look out for number one. Do unto others before they do unto you. I don't get mad, I get even. Maybe this is only certain parts of the world, but shoot first, ask questions later. Right? These are kind of familiar. In fact, a lot of you, you know, these phrases are very familiar to you. And a lot of you guys in particular, we read through these and that testosterone starts pumping, right? And we're like, yeah, that's me. You got a problem with that? Right? We kind of are wired this way. In fact, there's a little bit of a macho pride that comes along with this type of a thing. And I'd say, boy, I know what you're talking about. You're going to have to bear with me as we kind of walk through this, but there's something that's going on here in Jesus' teaching that is far greater than a lot of our kind of tough guy image or our tough guy reputation. And by the way, man, I want to tell you this too. We're not asking you to check your manliness at the door. I don't think that's what this is going to lead us to. In fact, if you might remember that Jesus was talking to some tough guys. James and John are called what? Remember? The sons of thunder. I don't think they got that nickname, you know, by going to the book club. This is a pretty strong statement of kind of their manliness. Peter, they called him the Rock. I mean, he's the original, right? He's the original Rock. This is the guy that took out his sword and chopped off the high priest's ear. In fact, I don't think he was aiming for the ear. This is a pretty tough guy. And these guys that were Jesus' disciples that he called to follow him, they were fishermen. I mean, they spent their lives on the docks. They lived their lives on the seas. They were carpenters. They were tough guys. And I don't think Jesus was asking them to change who they were. In fact, this is really a key point of this. But he is telling them and he is teaching them that their strength is going to have to be lived out in a completely different way if they're going to learn to be followers of Jesus. I got a feeling that as Jesus started to explain this, their heads were spinning. So Jesus says, number one, we're going to have to do battle with the tendency of our dog-eat-dog mentality. Number two, we're going to have to release our grip on our personal rights. And what I want to do here is I want to just walk down through these verses. In fact, in verse 38, Jesus first quotes from three different Old Testament verses. There's a reference in Exodus, there's reference in the book of Leviticus, and the reference in the book of Deuteronomy. All three basically say the same thing. We're going to read just one of them, but Exodus 21:24 says this, "And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." If you go to the Leviticus passage, if you go to the Deuteronomy passage, they all have that exact same phraseology. Eye for eye and a tooth for tooth. In fact, this is interesting. This idea, this eye for eye and tooth for tooth, for you history buffs, it represents the oldest law in the world known as the Lex Talionis. In fact, this law was given way back in the Code of Hammurabi in 2200 BC. You might have heard this term before, Lex Talionis, but it literally means lex has the idea of law, you can kind of hear it, and talionis has the idea of retaliation. I don't know if we have a slide for this, guys, but Lex Talionis, law and retaliation. So this is the law of retaliation, and it's been around, it's the oldest law we ever have recorded in history. And it really is this, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you can almost see these disciples' heads nodding. I mean, that's the way they lived. They were right with him. Jesus said, hey, you remember the Old Testament where it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And they're like, yeah, yeah, we know that. This is our life. This is how we live. And now Jesus comes with this revolutionary teaching. Verse 39, he says, "But I say unto you, resist not evil." Don't resist evil. And we all go, I mean, what does that mean? In fact, if you want to see this, the way the text flows here, there's almost a stop after the first part of verse 39. "But I say unto you that you resist not evil, kind of a slash, and then following that statement, what Jesus does is he gives us four little cameos drawn from four different life situations, each one of them dealing with what living for Christ should really look like, especially when you've been wronged, right? So it's a pretty simple outline for us. That's what we're going to do, all right? So he says, resist not evil. We're kind of like, what does that mean? And he's going to go on now in the next three verses to say, this is what it looks like. There's four different practical illustrations of what it should look like for you to resist not evil. I say unto you, here's what he describes. We're going to go through them, four of them here together. Number one, Jesus talks about responding to personal insult. All right, what happens when somebody personally insults you? And the application that he makes is that, or that we're going to make, is I must release my right to retaliation. Verse 39 says, whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Let me tell you why this phrase, smite on the right cheek, was a very specific metaphor. In fact, I didn't warn him about this, but Lawrence, would you come up here and help me just for a second? He was anxious to do this anyway, but this will be easy. Right here, Lawrence. If you're right-handed, right? Okay, let's pretend. Sit down, Lawrence. No, I'm just kidding. No, stay here. Let's pretend you're right-handed. If you were to punch me, show me what that would look like in slow motion. Yeah. Show me what that would look like. Slow motion. I won't punch you back, I promise. Okay, good. Just like that. Very good. Lawrence, if you were to smite me with your right hand on my right cheek, what would that look like?
With my right hand?
Yeah.
Probably back then.
Yeah, it would be, right? Good. That's all we needed. Good. Yeah. Thanks. That's all good. Right. Yeah, we're good. Does that make sense? Yeah, thank you. Give him a little hand. Good job, Lawrence. I was a little bit nervous. I mean, he's the school principal. I thought he could catch on, you know, quickly. So, yeah, actually, that's very specific. This is a very specific wording terminology, a phrase that's talking about smiting on, when he says very specifically on the right cheek. This is not a punch, right? Which is going to go to my left cheek. This is a backhanded smite on the right cheek. And most of us, even in our own cultures, probably already identified there's a difference in those two smites, right? One is more of a fighting terminology. The other is a insult, right? It's sort of a challenge. It's almost a dismissive, you're nothing. You don't mean anything. In that culture, just like it would be in a lot of other cultures, to ignore somebody smiting you on your right cheek was kind of the ultimate sign of weakness. Somebody's insulting you. They're challenging your manliness. You don't ever just ignore that. You have to somehow respond to it. And boy, I tell you, when someone insults you, doesn't that just make your blood boil? And you know what we want to do? I mean, it's natural. Well, we want to get even. We want to get payback. We want to find some way to find revenge, give them a little taste of their own medicine. I guess Winston Churchill was a master of words, both positively and negatively. He had a particular problem with a lady in the court named Lady Astor. We're told that on one occasion, she found Churchill very inebriated in a hotel elevator. And so with kind of cutting disgust, she snipped at him. She said, "Sir Winston, you are drunk." To which it's reported he replied, "My lady, you are ugly, and tomorrow I will be sober." And our natural self really likes that, don't we? Right? We like to get even with our words. Sometimes we like to get even with our actions. I, I heard a story, some of you might relate to this, about a soldier who was overseas away from his girlfriend, and he received, while he was away, a Dear John letter. A Dear John letter is sort of a breakup, a long-distance breakup. And so he received this Dear John letter from his girlfriend back home in the States. And so to add insult to injury, she wrote, "Will you please return my favorite photograph of myself? I need it for my engagement picture in the local newspaper." So the poor guy was devastated, but all the other soldiers came to his rescue. They went throughout their entire camp and they collected pictures of all the guy's girlfriends. And they filled up an entire shoebox and sent it to the girl along with a note from the guy saying, "Please find your picture and return the rest. For the life of me, I can't remember which one you were." Right? And we kind of like that, right? We're wired for this kind of revenge. Our tendency when someone insults us is to strike back and to get even physically, verbally, or otherwise. We think, "How dare you? You insulted me." And here's what Jesus said. He said, "You know, if you can process this," he said, "you're going to have to set aside your petty ways of getting even. When you get insulted," Jesus says, "just turn your cheek." And he's not talking just passively to let it go. I mean, this is a very proactive statement. He's saying proactively, you don't just let it go. You turn, you give them the other cheek. You are willing to take that insult again without retribution, without revenge. And here's the thing, if you've ever seen that kind of restraint in action, you walk away saying, "Man, that took great strength. That took incredible courage." Now, I tell you, I'm sure I'm not any different than most of us here. This goes against my grain. This goes against my psyche. I've got a little bit of, you know, competitive juices, you know, that are natural inside me, and I hope over the course of my life, God's trying to teach me some tough lessons about this. He's still working on some of this, but we don't naturally want to respond like this. And somebody says, well, doesn't that just make Christians doormats? I mean, I don't know if I could, I've heard this, I don't know if I could ever respect somebody that won't stand up for themselves. Doesn't that just mean Christians have to be doormats? And I really love this answer. John Stott said this, I think we've got it up on the screen, but Jesus' illustrations and personal example depict not the weakling who offers no resistance. They depict rather the strong man whose control of himself and love for others is so powerful that he rejects absolutely every conceivable form of retaliation. And this is the kind of strength that Jesus is talking about. And by the way, we're not going to have time to talk about this, but this is the kind of strength that Jesus demonstrated. This is what he lived throughout his trial and ultimately his crucifixion. This is what Jesus showed us. I remember my dad telling a story one time about when he was a very young pastor. My dad started a couple churches when he was in seminary, right out of seminary, and one of them was actually in the state of New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Started a little church down there, and I don't know a lot about this situation, except something happened. This little church was growing and moving forward, and they were making some kind of a decision, and they were having a discussion in a church meeting that got very, very upset. One person in particular got very upset in a church business meeting. And while in the meeting, Dad's kind of moderating the meeting, this gentleman stormed up to the front of this meeting and went toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose with my father. And this is the piece that I remember. I don't know why. I don't know the whole story, but I remember this. I remember hearing this as a little kid and thinking, wow, that was... I remember my dad saying, you know, I stood there and I purposefully took my hands and I balled up my fists and I thrust them into my pocket and I kept them there as firmly as I could because I was sure he was going to punch me. And when he did, I wanted everybody to know that my fists were in my pocket. You know, it's not natural for us to want to respond like that. I don't think it was natural for Jesus' disciples to want to respond like that. And you're asking, well, why? What's the point? And that piece you're going to have to wait till next week because we're going to come back to that. But this is what Jesus says. He says, this is how my disciples are going to be evidenced. So number two, I want to try to get to a couple of these. We're really just getting started with this. But the second, Jesus talks about responding to a violation of my rights. And the application that we're going to make is I must release my right to cling to what is fair. And again, if you think through what we're saying here, every one of these statements is very difficult because we're wired for fairness. We're wired for equity. And Jesus is telling us we're going to have to release that. Verse 40 says this, "And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also." So the law said that you could sue someone for their coat, which was their shirt or kind of their tunic. But their outer coat, which was essential for warmth, it was sort of a sun shelter. In fact, they would often use this outer coat as their blanket at night. You couldn't take that. In fact, in the book of Exodus chapter 22, it says this, "If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge or as an oath, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only, it is his raiment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep. And it shall come to pass when he crieth unto me that I will hear, for I am gracious." All right, so you could take away his shirt. Very literally, you could sue somebody for the shirt off their back, right? Literally. But you could not sue them for their coat. That was essential for them. It was illegal in order to do that. So Jesus said, hey, you know what? Even though you have every legal right to keep your coat, I don't want you fighting for your rights. Your spirit should be, okay, here it is. Christians, according to Jesus' teaching, we cannot be about fighting for our rights. Your rights are not as important as your testimony. The reason we think it's important, because our human nature wants things to be fair, and it just may not be. Fairness is not the important issue here. There's some of us here who have a real fairness meter. I mean, it's strong in us. We've probably had it for a long time. You know, if I get two, they get two. If this person gets three, they get three. I mean, it's very clear. We kind of, if things are unequitable in that way, it's very, very difficult for us. We're not going to take a lot more time on this because they're going to come back and kind of pull some pieces to it. But if you want a cross-reference on this, Romans chapter 12, 17 through 21, if you want to write that down, Romans 12, 17 through 21, helps to explain, I think, a little bit more about this idea about rights and fairness. Read verse 41, "And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him too." All right, so third, Jesus talks about responding to unfair treatment or unreasonable demands, and the application is, I must release my right to be in control or to be in charge or to get my way. So the picture here is this. The Hebrew people were under the control of the Roman army, and the Roman law stated that if a Roman soldier or another authority, if they came to you, they could at any time compel any citizen to carry a burden for up to 1 mile. Anytime. No matter what you were doing. No matter whether you had other things going on, if you were with your family, it didn't matter. At any time, a Jewish person, actually anybody across the Roman Empire, if a Roman soldier or a Roman authority came to you, they could compel you at a moment's notice to drop what you're doing, no matter how important you thought it was, and carry a burden that they asked you to do up to 1 mile. You can imagine how difficult this was on the subjects of the Roman Empire. Virtually every Hebrew in that time would have experienced this at some point. It was very common. You kind of think back, even on our island, if you think about maybe sometimes in our past when there's been some occupation, if you can imagine the occupiers having the right, the legal right, to say to anybody on the island at any time, hey, listen, I can stop whatever you're doing and you have to do this for me, this manual labor, whatever it might be. I mean, this is difficult. The Jews hated it. I mean, they hated it. They hated the idea of it. They certainly hated the reality of it. And here's what Jesus said. He said, when they ask you for 1 mile, that's all they can legally ask you for under the Roman law. They can't ask you for any more. One is too much, right? It's unfair. It's not right. Jesus said, when they ask you for one, go 2 miles. Go the extra mile. And the idea, I think, is this. Christian, you're going to find yourself at times under some authority that may not be pleasant. Authority, particularly bad authority, can really make life miserable. And you want to know what the problem is at the core? It's not really the work so much, what we've been asked to do. That's just time and a little effort. The issue for the Jewish people was not really just the work. I mean, that's frustrating. You might have something going on. You're with your family, and all of a sudden you got to stop and you got to carry their burden for a mile. The work is an issue. The time is an issue, but that's not the core issue. The battle really is this. We want to be in control. We want to be in charge. We want to get our way. And the authority may be unreasonable. And so we really naturally sort of chafe at this. We drag at this under the authorities in our lives. I mean, these Romans have no right. Who do they think they are? And Christian, you're going to experience this. And when you do, and you go the extra mile, and you do more than you're asked, more than required, and it may be unreasonable, and it might be unfair, and what Jesus is saying is, don't just do it. Don't just do it with a sullen attitude. Don't just do enough to get by. I made a commitment one time. I don't know that I've always fulfilled this, but I remember pretty specifically when this commitment was made, but I'm sure I heard it from somebody, but I wanted to be a 2 mile man in a 1 mile world. Not very many people are willing to do hard things that somebody asks them. And even fewer are willing to say, I can be humble enough that not only am I going to do what you ask, I can go beyond. You know, for all of us, there are always two ways to do any task. At your work, kids at school, maybe your job's at home, right? We can grumble and do the bare minimum to get by. Or we can do more than anyone would have a right to expect. I mean, I don't care what the job is. Chores at home, doing the dishes at home. I mean, we can just do what we need to get done with kind of a sullen spirit, or we can go at it in a way of a joyful spirit, knowing that ultimately we serve Christ. You can do that at your job, all across this room. I mean, we've got people working at all across our island at various schools, National Guard, the banks across the island, fire department, military, Reventax, Harvest Ministries, whatever your place is. We're going to come back to this, but your testimony is going to be dramatically impacted by how you respond to this teaching of Jesus. Last, let me just mention this. Jesus talks about responding to being used, and the application is, I must release my right to the mine syndrome. Verse 42 says, give to him that asks of you, and from him that would borrow of you, turn not thou away. Two things, real quick, and then I want to kind of pull this together and apply it. Two things. First of all, let me give you a couple of qualifiers, both for this and each of them, and I don't have time to talk about them in depth, but they'll help us. Number one, qualifiers of this, there are limits. There are limits. Each of these examples give a limit, all right? You do only have two cheeks, right? It's just your coat and your cloak. It does say 2 miles. There is limits. This is not an indefinite, you have to constantly do whatever anybody asks of you. And there would be more that we'd have to explore with this. But the point really is not to make new limits. The point really is to go beyond what others can expect. There's a very significant reason why that's true. We're going to see it out of 1 Peter next week. All right, so there are limits. Number two, we must take other biblical principles into account, and there's other biblical principles that apply into here, all right? I'm not negating them, and so we'll have to talk through some of those. And then number three, there's a place for godly appeals. There's a place for godly appeals. Paul appealed to the law. He appealed to the fact that he was a Roman citizen, to those who were intent on beating him in Acts chapter 22. He appealed. So one of the great skills that I think a godly Christian needs to learn is how to appeal to authority in a humble, submissive manner and then accept their verdict. I mean, this is, I think, a biblical principle of appeal, but this is part of the process. I wish I had more time on this. We're going to come back and talk about the why question next week. What is the point of all this? All right, so we've kind of laid out, I think, what Jesus had said. You're going to have to work through it on your own. I think it's pretty straightforward. So we laid out what Jesus said. I think the big question that we come away from this is why? What is the big deal that he'd bring these? And I'm sure these disciples are thinking the same thing. I mean, we've already kind of explained where they're coming from. Their personal independence was, I'm sure, flustered by this. So we got to ask why, and we're going to come back to that next week. About 15 years ago, October 2nd, 2006, a Pennsylvania dairy truck driver, apparently nursing a 20-year grudge, walked into a one-room Amish schoolhouse. Some of you will remember, it was such a shocking story. Walked into this Amish schoolhouse, and he first of all dismissed, I think, 15 boys and a couple of the adults out of this little schoolroom. And then he lined up 11 little Amish schoolgirls facing the blackboard, tied them up, and then over the course of the next couple hours proceeded to systematically attempt to execute these 11 innocent little girls. You might remember this story. I think there were four or five girls that died, six more that were injured, some of them very, very severely. It's a tragic story. We've seen too much of this. This story was 16 years ago. Unfortunately, we've seen other stories like this over the years. They just each time make us think about humanity. Why? Here's the thing that was so significant about that, and if you were kind of alert at all during that time, you'd probably remember this. The thing that was so dramatic about that story was the Amish community the dads and the moms, the brothers and the sisters, the uncles and the aunts of these five girls that had passed away, of all of these children who'd been traumatized, they offered forgiveness immediately. And it wasn't just in words, it was in actions. I mean, right away they reached out to the family. This man, after the schoolroom police had finally broke through. He committed suicide, so he died along with the girls that died in that room. And so the Amish community immediately, they reached out to the family. They set up a fund for the wife and her children, that whatever funds were given to the Amish community, a portion of those funds went to this wife to care for her children in the future. They reached out to this killer's parents, mom and dad, who'd lived in this community for a while, and they reached out and they specifically did things to care. They went to the funeral of the man who had killed their daughters. About 40 of them went to the funeral, and they formed a barricade to protect the family from the onslaught of the cameras and the media so that they could have some time to themselves as they grieved in the cemetery the funeral of their son. And the world watched and looked on with confusion. They said things like, one of the headlines are, "What are the Amish thinking?" And you put yourself in those shoes. I mean, what if those had been your children? Would you have immediately been able to offer the kind of forgiveness that these people offered so significantly? Lots of lessons, there's lots of stories about this, but I want to tell you this. It is just one more reminder to us about this, and this applies very specifically to the world that we're living in right now. That is, in the age and the hostility that we experience across so much of our world today, in our culture, people are drawn to authentic Christian commitment and behavior because it's so different. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit into our personal ideas or our cultural ideas of how we should respond when things are unfair. It is anti-cultural. And when it happens, our culture looks on and with somewhat dismay, but deep down, this dismay is a sense of what is different about them. And how, in this case, how can it result in this idea of a grace and forgiveness that allows a whole community to move forward in a healthy, forgiving, without the bitterness that so often comes? What's the answer to all that? Well, it's the overview of everything we've been talking about. The answer is this: Jesus changes everything. He does. And this morning, I want to tell you, if your life has not been changed, I'm not saying that you have all of the Jesus pieces in your life, that in every area of your life you're living just exactly as Jesus does. In fact, I wonder if there's anybody here that walks away from these verses thinking, "Oh yeah, I got that down." But listen, this morning, if Jesus hasn't changed you, if you're not living a life that's different from your unsaved, unbelieving friends and neighbors and coworkers, if there's not significant differences about you, then it's possible. In fact, I would tell you, you must evaluate whether Jesus has come into you, whether he's forgiven you, because it is true. Walking with Jesus and living for Jesus, he changes everything. And this is our desire, right? We want to be a body of people, a body of Christ, that evidences to our community, our island, and to a watching world that we're different. We see life different, and we do it in a way that honors our Lord and honors our God.